Good evening. This is Thursday, April 6th, and we're your hosts of the weekly science show, Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm Kai Brito, a.k.a. The Sly Kai, and...
And I'm Lincoln Tice. This week on the Perpetual Notion Machine, we'll be talking about a variety of current science news. First up, something a little bit political. The headline reads, "At Trump's EPA... Less science and more industry." This is an article from Bloomberg.com. It appeared April 4th. It says, "Congress and the Trump administration are planning sweeping changes in how science is used to govern public health. Controversy over climate change may be getting all the attention right now, but legislation under consideration would transform the way the EPA combats pollution, identifies harmful pesticides, and classifies everyday toxins, such as laundry detergent, window cleaner, and clothing dye. President Trump has vowed to flatten regulatory hurdles for American business, and Congress's proposed EPA rules for science would make commerce easier. The president has proposed a 31% budget cut for the EPA and installed an opponent of the agency, Scott Pruitt, as its leader. Pruitt began the new era of industry over environmental regulation last week by reversing years of scientific opinion, rejecting a proposed ban on chlorpyrifos, a pesticide used on fruits and vegetables that has links to brain damage. Bills under deliberation would open EPA expert advisory panels to industry representatives and mandate the use in formulating policy of what sponsors call the best available science, which opponents say would exclude widely used research methods and delay action. An EPA program that certifies consumer products that are free of hazardous substances could also be in peril. There's also this new law called the Honest Act, which the House passed 228-194 on Wednesday. It would bar the EPA from creating any regulation based on data that's not publicly available or can't be replicated. The law would mean eliminating studies that cite epidemiological research, such as the one that led to the banning of the pesticide DDT. So I had to look up what epidemiological means, and it's actually just using public health data to decide policy. So this would basically say that the EPA is not allowed to look at our health records. Isn't that crazy? Okay, so that's our first story. And now, what was our second story, Kai?
Our second story comes from an article written by Ed Yong in The Atlantic. It's titled, "No, We Cannot Say Whether Cancer is Mostly Bad Luck." This article stems from the 2015 paper that was published in Science titled, "Variation in Cancer Risk Among Tissues Can Be Explained by the Number of Stem Cell Divisions." That was written by Drs. Christian Tomasetti and Dr. Bert Vogelstein, scientists at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. The problem with this paper is that leading media outlets, Time Magazine, The Guardian, and BBC, perpetuated the scientific paper's findings as bad luck without fully understanding the context of this paper. Within the paper in the abstract, what the scientists titled bad luck actually refers to inherited genetics from your parents. Part of what the paper was trying to establish was that environmental factors are not as responsible for cancer occurring within your body in certain areas of the body as your genetics are in determining whether those cancers will start and or spread. So that is what some of the papers were including, but there were several rebuttals that were not included within these initial reports from these media outlets. One of the things they did not report or neglected to state was that this study had a lot of, well, first of all, rebuttals, but those rebuttals were formed on the premise that breast and prostate cancer, one of the major forms of cancer, were not included in the study. According to the National Cancer Institute, some of the main forms of cancer are lung, breast, prostate, colon, and rectal, which are often combined together. But those were not, well, some of those were not included. More significantly, breast and prostate were not included within the study. The problems that arise within understanding what happened in the sciences. How do we actually read science? What happened here was that journalists didn't make a full understanding of the article, and they actually published information that seems to be harmful and undermining towards public health advocacy. So how can you educate the public without first understanding the science yourself? That's what we have to ask ourselves. So tonight I thought we could maybe discuss ways that we can increase our scientific literacy and understanding. So this question is fielded to Lincoln. First of all, how do you think about science, and where do you get most of your science information?
That's a great question. I feel really fortunate to have had a great education in science at the UW. I try to get as much science as I can in the news. In researching for tonight's show, I found that the website for the journal Science is a really great resource. I don't know. How about you?
Usually where I like to look, Scientific American, Smithsonian, they have the Smithsonian Magazine, I should say. They have great publications on science. Another place I like to look is The Atlantic. I really enjoy The Atlantic's science news writing, especially Ed Yong, one of the more prolific writers of our times. I would say I'm definitely one of them, maybe fans of his writing. But those are some of the three main areas that I look. So one of the things that you should look for when you understand the science is that beyond just reading what the media headlines do or say, go to the actual publication and make sure you understand what were the methodologies included, what was looked at, what wasn't looked at, and understanding how should it be looked at, and see what other scientists are criticizing it for. Because 2 years down the road, this publication is actually coming up and resurfacing again. Just last month, in March of 2017, published again in Science from the same authors and a third co-author, they published a new article titled Stem Cell Divisions, Somatic Mutations, Cancer Etiology, and Cancer Prevention. Now, the research on this was more extensive. It was more inclusive of different types of cancer, and it had more robust statistical analyses. But it received some of the same criticisms for its methodology at the base. Some scientists still disagreed with some of the claims that they were asserting about cancer, about where it was popping up in the popping up within the body versus between people that can develop cancer. So whether or not you want to take away some understandings from their findings in the research, you have to look and decide for yourself, is this methodology worthy of scientists using for future recommendations? And that's the story.
Right. So basically, we can't always rely on outlets like Time Magazine or popular news sources to give us a good scientific understanding. Like in this case, they claimed that the study was finding that cancer is merely caused by bad luck when there are really all these environmental factors.
Well, I wonder what problems would arise if they just neglected to use the language bad luck. A lot of media outlets like to attach themselves to that. I mean, we had some very influential media outlets too. Time Magazine, BBC, The Guardian. I mean, those are people that when their audience that reads it, that's where a lot of people get their information. They're trustworthy. They're reliable. People look at those and say, oh, wow, if I'm reading from this article, maybe I don't need to check the sourcing because their namesake, the years that they've published or had publications and people building that trust, people don't look at it because, you know, do you need to look at it if you already know they're reputable? Well, maybe they didn't this time.
Yeah, and I think that's a really harmful situation too, because that might make people think that, oh, I'm going to, you know, it's totally the luck of the draw whether I get cancer, so I don't need to watch my diet or be healthy or stay away from these known carcinogens that, you know, these chemicals that exist.
Well, it might be playing into some confirmation bias. I mean, people that, especially when it comes to lung cancer, I mean, what is one of the leading causes of lung cancer? I'm pretty sure smoking would be on the list. So smokers going to read that and say, oh, wow, well, I guess I'm going to get lung cancer either way. Maybe I should just smoke myself into a coffin.
Great point. Okay, for our next story, comes from Norway, which doesn't seem so close to home, but it's actually about a disease that exists here in Wisconsin, chronic wasting disease, which is a big problem among our white-tailed deer. So the headline is, Norway plans to exterminate a large reindeer herd to stop a fatal infectious brain disease. It appeared, it was published April 3rd, also from Science Magazine. A year after a deadly and highly contagious wildlife disease surfaced in Norway, the country is taking action. Chronic wasting disease, or CWD, caused by misfolded proteins called prions, has already ravaged deer and elk in North America, costing rural economies millions in lost revenue from hunting. Its presence in Norway's reindeer and moose, the first cases in Europe, is a very serious situation for the environment and for our culture and traditions, says Bjørnar Terris, a veterinary researcher at the Norwegian Institute for Nature Research in Trondheim. So last week, their Minister of Agriculture and Food gave the green light for hunters to kill off the entire herd in which three infected individuals were found. That's 2,000 reindeer, or nearly 6% of the country's wild population. We have to take action now, says Karen Johan Balsrud, Director of Plant and Animal Health at the Norwegian Food Safety Authority in Oslo. The deer's habitat will be quarantined for at least 5 years to prevent reinfection. The odds of a successful eradication, experts say, will depend largely on how long CWD has been present in Norway. So this is really interesting to me because, you know, here in Wisconsin, CWD has been a problem for quite some time, and we haven't attempted any. I mean, we have been killing a lot of deer, but it hasn't prevented CWD from spreading basically throughout the entire state. So it will be really interesting to see if this is successful in Norway.
Right, and a lot of what Wisconsin management, how big is deer hunting in Wisconsin? You know, we have a really big season for it. So around from the time to September to about January, people can go out, take their bows and arrows, crossbows, guns, and kind of bring back some deer because it's a little bit of a Wisconsin tradition. I mean, I've never taken part in myself. I've always wanted to. But these are things that people really like to do. I mean, how many people go do this? In 2009... there was estimated 700,000 people in Wisconsin that brought to the state's economy just in deer hunting alone. I mean, think about how much money you're paying in licensing. This is a big source of revenue for Wisconsin. And if we lose our deer population, what is that going to do? And also, you know, populations of where we encounter problems of like overpopulation. If there's overpopulation, there's disease going around. Think about the epidemiology of that. How are things going to be spreading around within an overpopulated area? Competition for resources. There's a lot of problems we need to think about there. And it's not that it doesn't affect us either. I mean, there's the recreational value of going out there and hunting your own deer and saying like, oh, this is what my family's always done. If we live in, you know, some areas close to foresting, that might be more of a practice for them, or even for people in the city, you know, like to go out and just enjoy going out and hunting some deer during deer hunting season. But other than that, I mean, deer kind of, you know, like there are ways of controlling, what's it called? There are ways of controlling the understory and the undergrowth, like what are they eating? So that could have some effects on how plant and vegetation structures are occurring in forests. Who knows?
Absolutely. Yeah, I didn't actually realize that, you know, our chronic wasting disease here in Wisconsin in deer could spread to elk in Europe. That's really shocking to me. So they say it has probably been spread in part by shipments of infected animals. And many species of cervids, that's including elk, moose, and deer, are affected. I'll read a little bit more from the article. Infected animals typically begin showing symptoms such as weight loss, lethargy, and drooling 2 to 3 years after infection, and then die within months. In Wyoming, where CWD has been endemic for decades, up to 40% of some herds are infected, and white-tailed deer populations are declining by 10% a year. CWD is very contagious. Prions spread easily through saliva, urine, and feces, and can linger in the environment for years, which suggests that feeding stations and salt licks are hot spots of infection. Yeah, prions are super fascinating. It's basically just when a brain protein folds in a strange way, and then it can cause other brain proteins to fold in that exact same way.
Isn't it kind of scary? I mean...
Super scary. Yeah, this is mad cow disease. And it's also found, it's also in a human disease called Kuru, which was found in cannibalistic societies.
I haven't heard of that myself.
Yeah, but, brain encephalopathies.
So what are some methods that people can take to control chronic wasting disease? How are we controlling this in our own state and international as well?
Well, this is, of course, very controversial.
Culling, we've mentioned.
Yeah, culling. The easiest way to control CWD, in my opinion, would be to ban feeding of deer, because when deer are all congregating and eating out of, like, a trough of corn, that's when their saliva is going to come in contact with each other. When they're grazing in their natural environment, it's much less likely for CWD to be spread. But that, of course, is politically controversial in Wisconsin because hunters want the freedom to be able to feed deer because that will make it easier for them to harvest deer come hunting season.
Mm. I would say that also, too, controlling our own water resources. Water is one of the most common vehicles for environmentally transmitted diseases to spread. I mean, water just kind of harbors and allows these diseases to sit in their water. I mean, we see similar problems encountered with bird flu. And actually, one of the things I'd like to mention is that culling is a common form of control method for bird flu. I mean, we see many, many cullings of birds, especially in areas like China. Actually, I was just reading an article on how a different strain of virus, if you might remember the panic of H1N1. Now there's a new strain in China coming out, H7N9, and that's increasing the amount of cullings that are occurring in China and other areas that are kind of susceptible to the epidemic. These are ways, because when it starts spreading to humans, what do you do? I mean, maybe we don't spend enough time prioritizing our own animal populations, but how do you control it within that population? There's too many areas where it might be spreading. Vectors is what I believe they're called.
Huh, so they're actually culling wild bird species in China, or domesticated birds?
Well, I want to say what I have read, Anseriformes and Cariformes. So those are like shorebirds, and I forget what it corresponds to. I want to say shorebirds and freshwater birds, similar to like ducks. I would say ducks are a good poster child of what the freshwater birds would be, and then things like gulls, terns, those would be some of the things like more ocean-based. So those two forms, same disease, different kind of habits of animals.
Wow, so that's very ethically fraught, too, to be killing, you know, large numbers of indigenous wild species just to potentially prevent the flu. That's very interesting. Okay, so going back to the prions in the elk. The prions resemble those found in North American deer. How the disease got to Norway is a mystery. Prions may have arrived in deer urine, which is bottled in the United States and sold as a lure. Or perhaps they hitched a ride on hiking boots or hunting gear.
Yeah, I will say that is a lure commonly used to attract deer because it, well, one, I think it, I'm not sure about this, but doesn't it cover your scent as well, the scent of human beings? So using deer urine, it tells you where other deer are going to be and where you might be looking for other resources. That's the form of attraction for it, right? So, yeah. Moving on. Just had to confirm that with Lincoln. Okay, so next up, we have to discuss, should we invest in robots for U.S. workers? Is that doing something for us? Automation is replacing jobs within the manufacturing sector. According to PricewaterhouseCoopers, or PwC, 38% of American jobs are at high risk for being replaced by technology within the next 15 years. According to the BLS, the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, the U.S. has lost 5 million manufacturing jobs since 2000. We have to try and understand, why is this happening? Well, according to Dr. Nicholas Correll, assistant professor of computer science at the University of Colorado, he says, Among many factors, international competition from China and robotic development becoming cheaper are two main reasons why this could be occurring. Within the international competition reason, Chinese exports and a low-wage labor seems to be contributing to how fast they can get out products and materials and increase trade within that country. And within robotics development, technology booms and development of new technology, think smartphones, think new self-driving cars coming out. Our innovations within technology are coming out every single year, and we get more developments and more increases in advancements of how we are operating our technology, user interfaces and efficiencies, and how much energy is being used. These are some areas like where, since we're coming so far, technology needs to get cheaper to meet the demand that we are bringing upon it. So what we take away from this is, how will this affect the U.S. working class population? Well, some people believe that this could increase opportunity, but when we think about that loss of manufacturing and increasing the opportunity for us to use technology, we have to think about who is going to have access to that. So are we going to need a more skilled workforce? And are people going to need more training for that? Or are we going to be able to keep up with the demand for technology rise? Lincoln, do you have any thoughts on that?
Personally, I think that automation and technology in the U.S. is definitely going to help the U.S. manufacturing sector, just because our workers make higher wages than workers in other countries. So without advanced manufacturing here in the U.S., we're going to continue to lose manufacturing jobs to other countries that don't have as much, you know, safety for workers or the environment, and obviously don't have the higher wages that we have here in the U.S.
Okay, thoughts from Lincoln. Moving on to our next story, Lincoln.
Okay, my next story is quite fascinating. The headline is Dark Energy an Illusion? This is, again, from Science Magazine. It was published on April 3rd. For the past 20 years, physicists have known that the expansion of the universe is accelerating, as if some bizarre dark energy is blowing up space like a balloon. In fact, cosmologists' well-tested standard model assumes that 69% of the content of the universe is dark energy. However, there may be no need for the mysterious stuff, a team of theorists claims. Instead, the researchers argue, the universe's acceleration could be driven by variations, or inhomogeneities, in its density. If so, then one of the biggest mysteries in physics could be explained away with nothing other than Albert Einstein's familiar general theory of relativity. Other researchers are skeptical, however. If it's right, somebody is going to have to take back Nobel Prizes, awarded in 2011 for the discovery of the accelerating expansion of the universe, says Nick Kaiser, a cosmologist at the University of Hawaii in Honolulu. Tom Giblin, a computational cosmologist at Kenyon College in Ohio, who has worked on a similar analysis, says, I would love if inhomogeneities explained dark energy. However, he says, I don't see any evidence from our simulations to expect it to be as big an effect as they see here. So the first time I read this, I was a little bit confused. But basically what this article is saying, a theory of relativity is that, well, obviously there's gravity, right? So gravity is a function of mass. Like, mass creates gravity. So in areas of the universe where there's a lot of mass, like a very dense galaxy, lots of stars and planets, there's more gravity. So that's going to keep them together, right? But in areas of the universe that are less dense, there's less gravity, so that's going to enable those areas to expand more. So basically what this theory says is, we know the universe is expanding, right? So that means that things are getting further apart, that a lot of areas of the universe are becoming less dense, so basically that creates less gravity, and that's what's actually causing the universe to expand faster.
It's actually like a feedback loop.
Exactly, yeah. It's a positive feedback. So you know, the more things spread apart, the more they will continue to spread apart.
So
basically,
how does that rank with our little galaxy here, the Milky Way? Are we going to expand off into the distance anytime soon?
Gosh, I have no idea, but obviously space-time is way, you know, takes a lot longer than our human lifetime, so I sort of just worry about the things that might happen.
As much as people might not like to think, I do like waking up in the morning and seeing the sun if I do go to bed, so I would prefer to be able to do that. I like our nighttime cycles, day and night cycles. Okay, Lincoln, next story. And our last story.
Well, for my last story, I guess I'll go back to Europe. The headline is The Original Brexit, How Tremendous Ice Age Waterfalls Cut Off Britain from Europe. For millions of years, Britain was part of Europe. A high ridge of limestone, now famously exposed as the chalky cliffs of Dover, extended all the way to what is now France, allowing mammoths, hippos, and eventually humans to freely pass back and forth. But about 450,000 years ago, this rocky road was cut off by a flood of unimaginable proportions. Now, a team of researchers has detailed evidence of how this torrent of destruction was unleashed. They've managed to identify how the ridge was breached, says geologist Philip Gibbard of the University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom, who is not involved in the current study. I'm quite enthusiastic. The idea that enormous floods quickly carved parts of the English Channel was first proposed in 1985. At that time, geologist Alex Smith of Bedford College in London noticed large, interweaving scour marks on maps of the English Channel seafloor. The patterns of erosion resembled those of channeled scablands, a starkly eroded landscape in eastern Washington state that was formed by floods from glacial lakes that burst their icy dams between 15,000 and 18,000 years ago. So that would be the Columbia River Gorge, I believe. It may have been several hundred kilometers wide. This is a massive glacial lake, and it likely filled the southern part of the North Sea. Because so much water was stored on land as ice sheets, sea levels were likely 120 meters lower than today, exposing the bottom of what is now the English Channel. With the chalk ridge forming a dam to the south, and the Rhine and other rivers flowing into the glacial lake, the water would have kept rising. Smith proposed that the lake would have eventually cascaded over the chalk cliffs. As evidence, he pointed to large, deep pits at the base of the former ridge, plunge pools, that were formed by the force of the waterfalls and later filled in with sediment. Eventually, he says, a major flood would have created the scour marks on the channel bottom. Still unknown was what unleashed the deluge.
Well, water certainly can be scary. It is both necessary for life and also seems like it's sometimes something you don't want to be seeing the true force of nature unleashing on you. That's it for today. This is PNM, Perpetual Notion Machine.